Hi, everybody. I'm Andy Richter. You're listening to The Three Questions, and I've got Brett Gelman on today. How about that? Isn't that exciting? You are soaking up all the work. You are in everything these days.
Oh my God, I'm glad to hear you say that. You know,
why it doesn't feel, yeah, it never feels like that, does it?
No, not at all. I mean, I feel very grateful and I intellectually know that, but I think, you know, the trauma of not having worked for so long and the fear of never working again.
Oh, yes.
Is always creeping in.
Yeah, yeah. No, I, for me, the big turning point was that it was like some Tom Clancy movie on cable where you play like a terrorist. And I was so happy to see you in like, because it's like there's no comedy in that movie whatsoever, you know.
No.
And because usually, you know, like you're in things where it's kind of fun, you know, like you've been in some great stuff where just for drama, but mostly people get you because would you say you're essentially a comedian? I mean, because
I would say that, I mean, that's my roots, you know, I'm trained in all, you know, in all things theater and acting. And I definitely, I strive to do more and more drama, but I mean, you're either funny or you're not.
Yes.
And so if you're funny, it's really ridiculous not to utilize that and to abandon that completely. But like, I do love to do drama, and I love that I'm getting the chance to do more of that, and I want to do more of that, but I never want to abandon comedy. And up to this point, even things that I've done for the most part that have drama in them, like Lemon or Fleabag, there's still a lot of, there's still comedies.
Oh, you know? Yeah. I mean, because like Fleabag, I feel that's a comedy. Like that whole thing is, you know,
absolutely.
I mean, it's meant to be, I mean, there's absurdist comedy that isn't full of jokes, you know, that is just about the human condition, but it's supposed to be entertaining in the way that, you know, a joke is. It's, you know, like I always felt like Breaking Bad is a comedy, my opinion. Just because it's an absurd situation. Bryan Cranston is a comic actor. Like I can't see him in things without seeing him be comic. I mean, that's not entirely true I can never remember the names of anything, but like there was an amazing miniseries where he played the father of a kid that gets caught. Remember that? He's like, it's
the
New
judge.
Orleans. Yes, the judge. And that wasn't funny, you know, like there was nothing funny about that. Check it out and you'll see what I mean about it not being funny. But like there was so much Walter White to me that was just hilarious.
Well, yeah, no, totally. I mean, Breaking Bad, like The Sopranos, is if you give that log line, it's a total comedic concept.
Right, right. Absolutely.
You know, nerdy school teacher gets cancer and decides to start selling meth and becomes the biggest meth dealer in the country.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. You know, mob boss has a panic attack and starts seeing a psychiatrist while trying to keep his power. In the
right,
mafia.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And both of those shows, I mean, are very funny. And that's an amazing thing when you get to, when you're sort of existing in that gray. That's phenomenal.
Do you feel like a palpable difference, it generally speaking, between being on a drama set and being on a comedy set?
I think that the difference is that in comedy and drama are hard in different ways. Comedy, you have to do everything that you're doing in drama, but still have a technical state of mind at some point in your brain to be delivering timing, jokes, you know, the way you deliver something. In drama, you can abandon all of that for the most part, you know, depending on, I mean, I think there's maybe some people that you work with that have a distinct style in drama that you would need to technically adhere to. But with that, the difficult thing about that is just plunging into,
right,
you know, however you do it to get there, pain.
Right.
But you're still plunging into pain and comedy. You're still doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, but I think for people who are comedically inclined, there is also, like, as you're plunging, you're also simultaneously releasing.
Yeah.
And that's really hard to do. I mean, to have like an ironic state of mind, it's just a particular state of mind that I guess, like, I'm not going to say is easy, but it's not like, it's what you and I are built to do.
Yeah.
It's what you and I are built to do. Am I just saying obvious things here?
No, not at all. Because that question of releasing it, and it is, you know, it's pain or it's embarrassment or it's frustration, and on a comedy set, you are releasing it because to me, it was always like, I always felt the difference was because I haven't done a lot of drama stuff, but generally speaking, they're like not as fun. Like there's a seriousness, you know, that especially like with the text, it's like a little bit more, because, you know, I like to fuck around. And so it's like when you have to go through things six times for camera blocking to have fun with it, just to kind of keep the ball, like a balloon that you're batting around in the air. So, you know, you change it up, you make little jokes, you keep people laughing on the set. And I felt sometimes at drama like, no, don't do that, because everybody's trying to pull in, you know. And I don't know, it might just be my asshole way of working.
Well, I think like a drama thing, there's not an overall agreement of how to do a drama.
Yeah.
You know, dramatic actors all have a different process. You have some dramatic actors who will joke around between takes.
Right.
You know, even if they're doing an intensely dark scene.
Yeah.
Or they'll mostly joke around, and if something is really intense, they're like, hey, sorry, I got to focus a little bit to like just get here. And then you got your people who are like in a corner all day when they're not acting, which is their process.
And
there's great people who do that and who are nice too, who do
that.
Hating on
I know
that.
What you mean.
Just,
yeah.
But
I just feel like, oh, that's not, that can't be fun.
I mean, I'm doing something right now. I'm on a project. I'm doing this show with Alma Harrell, who did Honey Boy, and with like Natalie Portman.
Oh yeah.
And that's a very free set. I mean, that's very free, but instead of like being free with jokes, it's being free with like all these feelings and making it a mess, you know, making it messy in that, Cassavetes type way, and everybody likes to talk about Cassavetes when we talk about improvisational improv. But I think that Alma is somebody who really, her work deserves that, you know, deserves to be put in that category. And because she's a genius, and working with the actors on that, they're like incredible. But they're not, nobody's really in a corner. They're really like, you know, it's like dealing with the character and the circumstances of that and doing what you need to get into that. And sometimes you gotta, but it's fun. It's also fun to like get into, I have found the fun in getting into a state. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
But like a procedural to me, that would be like maybe not so fun. when you're providing dramatic exposition.
Yes.
If you're doing something where you can really like dive into a character and go fucking nuts. And at that point, maybe something funny, like the director and your collaborators are like, something funny might come out of this.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
And so it's just full freedom. To me, like that's great drama.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sometimes like comedy can be stodgy too, where there's no freedom in that. And you're like, Jesus, these jokes aren't funny and we're having to stay to it.
Absolutely.
I've worked
on TV shows out here where in the writer's room, there was the feeling of quit screwing around, everybody. We got to write comedy, you know? And it's like, oh, that's not, I don't know. I, as much as I might not know everything, but I know that that's not really a great way to do it if you really want it to be funny.
Yeah. Being on that sitcom set where you have the writers and it's a single cam.
Yeah.
And you have the writers laughing hysterically at jokes, whether they work or not. Mm. And being like, guys, you're not going to be in the living room of these people.
No.
And maybe they'll like it even. I don't, though. It's not funny. And so,
yeah.
And so I think basically, if people are free in either genre, that's the way to be. And if people are too uniform and have too much of a preconceived idea of how it should be, regardless of what's happening in front of them on set or on stage, then that's a bad environment to be in. And I've been lucky to, and regardless of what I work with, the people who are leading those shows or those films are not like that for the most part, at least in the last like 6 years, I'm grateful for that.
Yeah. Yeah, you get to do a lot of fun stuff. It's really enviable. To be blunt.
Yeah. I mean, to hear you say that. I mean, like, I've always really admired you a lot, I think.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I mean, like, the first time I saw you was Cabin Boy.
Yeah, probably.
And that's a fully realized character. It's funny to hear you talk like, because I'm like, oh, that's like, I know, like, I look at that, I'm like, Andy knows what that guy had for breakfast this morning. Even if you didn't think that thought, like, it's just like, it was such a character of like, so it was so vulnerable, you know? And
yeah, that was playing the dumb man child. I was called on for that a lot. Still am. And I mean, and I'm happy to do it because it's a never ending font of good times. Like,
And I'm the guy, I always play the guy you probably not going to want to hang out with. Whether he's a bad guy or a good guy, you're not going to want to hang out with him.
A little too much energy. Just a little too much.
Kind of like me. Kind of like how I really am.
Now, were you that way? Have you been that way? Like, I had forgotten this too. I'd known it at one point, but you and I are both from the Chicagoland area. You're from Highland Park.
And you're from there too. And you came up in the Chicago scene and I came up in the New York scene, but that was it was completely influenced by the Chicago scene.
Right.
It was a Chicago scene in New York. You know, we were learning Chicago comedy and improvisational values. We just happened to be in New York City. And that was from, learning by watching you and everybody and, taking classes and performing there.
Were you a funny, incorrigible type of kid in Illinois growing up?
I think like I was more of a weird, desperate, strange, highly sensitive kid.
We can laugh about it now.
Yeah, because I'm all good now. I'm Mr. Balance. No, I didn't already do at least two things that I highly regret today. I was a weirdo. I was, very strange. And I wasn't like somebody who was proud of being strange. I wanted to be popular. I wanted to be normal. It just wasn't going to happen. And everybody around me constantly reminded me of that. And in one way I'm like, oh my God, I was abused. And in another way I was like, maybe I was just like so annoying and horrible deserved to like get like thrown down the stairs.
How do your parents deal with this, as a kid? Like, do they know that?
I think my parents were concerned. And, also were crazy in their own way and lacked boundaries. I mean, like a very typical, like, Eastern European Chicago Jewish household.
Not
a lot of, like, emotional control and boundaries.
Yeah.
But deep loyalty. Deep loyalty.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were always support. You know, I was like, in my mother's eyes, I was, I think, always right. Mm. And in my father's eyes, I think he was like, I'm not even going to go there.
Just kind of like you, that's your department, kid. You worry about all that, all that stuff, like, out of the house. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was an old school dad, and he was kind of like shut down. And like, I think a lot of the time being like, how'd I get here? Yeah. Is this what I want? But yeah, not knowing, not having the tools to ask those questions in a healthy way.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of just letting those questions eat at him as the years went by. Yeah.
Oh, the unexamined life is still good for a few yucks. Yeah.
Oh my God, I know, especially in this day and age. I mean, there's really a lot of people that really still believe in that. And I'm jealous of them in a way.
Because it is like, and there is a differentiation because you don't have any kids, right?
No, I don't. I plan on that. It's not a stance. It's just, yeah.
No, I understand. But just because I do have kids and it does, I talked to this about parents, like today, you know, parents that are my age, like it's such a night and day difference in terms of the involvement of parents in their children's lives now, to the point of, I mean, you know, sometimes the pendulum has swung too far and there are parents that are far too involved in their kids. But I mean, the notion of, like, when I having kids go up through grade school, when there'd be the parent night and they'd sit there and tell me what kind of math they were learning, I would always just be like, why are you telling this? This is between you and the kid. Like, I don't want to know about this, you know? And I mean, I don't even know that. I think maybe like my mom went to those things. And even then she was probably bored because I was homework, schoolwork. I was on my own. You know, it was like, you know, you probably don't want C's, do you? No. Well, you better work a little harder. Okay. You know, that was the extent of it. That was the extent of it. And with my kids, it's, you know, tutors and educational psychologists and, you know, so they can excel as much as they can. And I don't know, you know, I mean, it's great in some ways, but it's also, I wonder sometimes if it's too much. Basically, I guess. I don't know why I'm telling you that, but
I'm fascinated in it. I mean, I, you know, of course, there's a lot of people in my life with kids. I mean, it's wild. I mean, me and my girlfriend have two dogs, and don't worry, I'm not going to get into the whole thing of comparing being a dog parent to a human parent.
Yes, yes.
Because, you know, human people with children, they love that when dog owners do that.
Well, you'd have to feed them and pick up their poop. You know, there is a similarity. Yeah.
But I do think I'm like, I definitely like care about like how I behave around my dogs more probably than my father cared about how he behaved around me.
Oh my God.
I definitely like, and that my dad was a great dad in a lot of ways.
But yeah.
Like,
yeah.
He definitely wasn't like, oh, how is my anger over this crumb on the floor affecting my son's level of anxiety right now?
Like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm definitely like more concerned about.
Yeah.
And so I imagine when I do have kids, that it'll be along those lines. But I guess it's like a push and pull, right? Some days you're like, we're diving in, and then other days you're like, whoa, ease back,
right? And also there are days too where it's like, look, I'm just gonna try and hang out in the background until dinner time. You know, like, I'm just gonna, you know, like, I'm not gonna get that involved. And, you know, and you can, so there's days when that's really, really necessary too. But yeah, you're right. The anger too, the harnessing your anger. I learned that throughout my fatherhood. I used to just be this angry fucking guy sometimes. And I would say like, well, that's what dads are. And it's like, yeah, but why? Why does it, you know, like, you know, all that shit you don't like about yourself? don't you think maybe it's because that all that screaming about nothing that you grew up with? Oh yeah, that probably did cause some issues. I should maybe lay off the screaming.
No, it's very disturbing when I feel that I'm like channeling my parents' flaws.
Yes.
In almost like mirroring, like they're possessing me. It feels like.
Yes.
It's one of the most disturbing feelings.
It's just plain icky. Like when I hear myself and I hear my mom or I hear my dad, it is gross. It's just yuck. What am I doing?
I can feel a facial expression that my father had on my face and like, ooh, let's get this out of here. it's very scary because that's one of the fears, right? That we become our parents and that we just continue along the path of their flaw. Don't learn from their mistakes. Just make the mistakes all over again.
Yes.
Can't you tell my love's a growing?
Well, how does an anxious kid, hungry for acceptance, get into acting? Like, you know, like the reject-a-thon of acting.
I saw A Night at the Opera when I was 6 years old. I rented the video from the public library.
Uh-huh.
And then I just got obsessed with comedy. I got obsessed with Mel Brooks, you know, the original SNL cast.
The oldies, yeah.
Yeah, Eddie, you know, Murphy, Peter Sellers.
Yeah.
And then a little bit older, Monty Python. And also, like, the whole cast of the Brooks movies, to this day, I think are some of the greatest. I mean, even Gene Wilder aside, who to me is, you know, a gold standard. I mean, people like Malin Kahn, Harvey Korman, and Cloris Leachman, and Dom DeLuise, and Marty Feldman, and Kenneth Mars. That whole company really, I was like, that's how I want to act. That's how I want to act right there. And then seeing Gilda and Bill Murray, Belushi, Aykroyd, John Candy, you know.
Yep.
Yeah, it just was like, it was wanting to be these people. And I think that was very much in a fantasy place. And it took me a while of like going to theater camp. It was even up until high school where I was like, am I funny? I don't even know if I am funny. Mm-hmm. And then in high school, I started to get, really what happened was I just was so angry that I started to filter that through being funny. And there was sort of a, I think it's when you, I think anger is one of the things, one of the positivities of anger is that it really can help you in moments abandon, at least even if you're in denial about it, not caring what people think of you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the greatest training in comedy and acting is like going up on, how many shows have we done? I used to do shows at UCB all the time. And that started, and I think that trend sort of started in high school of like, let me see how much I can make these people hate me right now in a way. There were those moments.
Yeah. Was it a conscious thing, or would it just kind of come out as an instinctual thing?
I think it was being angry at the audience and being fed up with like trying to be funny and bombing. Just being like, well, you know what? It was like seeing the audience as the bully. And then that one day being like, you know what? Fuck you. Fuck you. You know, I'm crazy. I'm not even funny. I'm crazy. I'm going to kick your ass. Like, that's what I think some of those like one in the morning shows were at times. And then sometimes you would do that and it would lead to great results and it would, you know, teach me something.
Yeah.
But I felt like very shy. You know, I felt very much like a student of comedy, a student of acting, rather than an actor or a comedian until really high school, until I started. I had a great theater department in Highland Park High School that was like, there was a great, we were being taught advanced stuff, maybe too advanced. and And then I would drive to the city and take classes at Second City.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was, I felt very much like a student. And then it was also sort of like, I felt like I had to like will myself to be funny. I felt like I had to will myself to decide that I was funny, to decide that I had presence. Like mm-hmm. I would sometimes just think about like, and this lasted, I mean, it still does. It still does. Like that idea of taking up space, like big enough space to fill a stage, fill a set, fill a character, you know, yeah. fill a made up world.
Yeah.
And everything about childhood and adolescence is designed for people to make you not take up space.
Yes. Minimized. Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, less, less, less.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And in adulthood, it's like, that's like one of the big struggles of how to behave is like, yeah. okay, maybe I do need to be less here. Oh, it is too much.
Yeah. Yeah.
It actually
yeah.
is too much.
Yes. Yes. And also too, sometimes being less is just a nice break. You know, it's relaxing, you know?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Those days where I can not say anything in reaction yeah. to something.
Mm-hmm.
They're few and far between.
I
feel like that's a real accomplishment.
I have felt just throughout my life, there's like different things that I think are like, oh, that's being a grown up. Like there's like different, like the main one that I think about being a grown up is like two conflicting things at one time. Like your mother being a source of warmth and love and encouragement and why you're who you are in so many of the best ways, and then also like a destroyer of you, you know, the person that can also like make you just burn you to the ground if she feels like it. And I mean, and even if she doesn't feel like it, if she's just, you know, just kind of does it. And it's like those two things coexist. And another one of those is learning when you don't say, sometimes you being a grown up is don't say it. Don't say anything. You think it, whatever, but just shut up. Don't say it. That's, no, you know.
Oh, yeah. All of my therapy is built around boundaries. About yeah. it's That's it.
Yeah.
It's just boundaries. It's like, stay in your lane. Don't, you know, don't make it about that. Make it about you. And if it's not working for you, then you got to do what you need to do in order to
yeah.
either to tolerate that or separate from it. And yeah. And that's really hard because I'm somebody who instinctually wants to ram my head into the brick wall and break it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I wasn't raised with boundaries.
right. Yeah.
I was raised with confrontation. I don't think we ever left the house and there wasn't a fight right wow. before we left.
Yeah.
I don't think that happened. Like I can count on my one hand how many times that happened. And it was normally about my mother taking too long to get ready.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember, I think I've mentioned it here, like one beautiful summer night walking home from football practice and it was warm. So it must have been like, you know, like the beginning of the school year, maybe even before school started. And I just remember it was a beautiful sunset and just, it was a perfect weather. And I was walking home and just you know, it's kind of country out there, is a little rural. And it just was so beautiful. And I kid you not, I was like a quarter of a mile from my house. And I heard, my mother screaming at one of my siblings. And I just was like, oh my God, you know?
Yeah.
And then even as I walk up to the house, it's like this beautiful old farmhouse and all the windows are open and the screen porch is open and, you know, like warm light inside. And but coming from outside is just like, oh,
a lot of God. Mothers are a lot of mothers. I don't want to generalize, but a lot of mothers are tricky. Mothers are like, Los Angeles. And I don't want to generalize too much again. And fathers, and I'm saying like your father could be your mother, you know, your father could be your mother could be your father. So I'm saying the archetype of the behavior, mother types are tricky. They're like Los Angeles. They're like, I love you or do I not?
Like,
does my love come with conditions?
Yeah,
is it unhealthy to love me too much? Is it unhealthy for me to love you too much? Where fathers are like New York. We're like, this is the way it is. And it's straight up.
Right.
And either you like it or you don't. And if you don't, you know, get the fuck out.
Whatever. Whatever. Yeah. Not my problem.
Exactly.
Yeah. I also
it's like the rules are laid out.
I also, as I've gotten older, I feel like mothers... So many mothers are angry, and then you realize, like, oh, and they have lots of reasons to be angry. Like, they're like, oh, they're frustrated and fed up, and you're like, okay, yeah, I get it. I see. Yeah, I would be too. Yeah.
Yes. No, it is, as much as fathers like to think that it's harder to be a father.
Oh, no.
I mean, there's no comparison.
Comparison whatsoever.
There's no comparison. It's way harder to be a mother.
Even if it's in the sort of like traditional sense, making money is a breeze compared to dealing with feelings, you know, like a household full of feelings. It's, you know, making money doesn't talk back, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. I mean, if you're a straight cis woman and you're the mother, it's life is just harder for you. If you're gay, or if you're queer and you're a mother, life is harder for you outside of just being in the family.
Yes. Yes.
You know, societally, that's not a word.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's harder. And then you got the family dynamic on top of that. So it's just, they don't have it easy and have to map out a lot of things.
Yeah.
So,
well, when you started wanting to get into, I'm sorry, I interrupted you there.
No, I'm done. Okay. I'm done. No, you're
done. How were your parents when you said, like, because you ended up kind of going to theater school, yeah?
Yeah, they were supportive.
Oh, that's good.
They were supportive. Yeah. They were. They were always really, really supportive. I mean, occasionally maybe my dad made like a crack a couple times. About like, no, he never really did. They just knew it was my dream from such an early age. And I think that they were so concerned about my emotional and mental well-being. They were like, I mean, the only choice is to support him or he might kill himself or kill us. So,
or both. Why not
or both?
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully it's both if it's going to be anything.
It'll be so much easier on the relatives if it's
that
both.
That way we can stay together. That way we can all stay together forever.
Talk about loyalty.
Yeah, but they were intensely supportive. Yeah. Outside of like normal narcissism.
Yeah, right. No, I know.
Like making it about them, but like in terms of my dreams and fulfilling that, they were really supportive. There was no question of me going to drama school. Never me doing this with my life. Yeah.
And you went to
somewhere
in North Carolina, right? Wasn't it
Yeah. I went to North Carolina School of the Arts.
How did you find that? How does a kid from Highland Park figure out to go to North Carolina?
It was
and
wild.
Is there culture shock? It's culture shock, isn't it?
Absolutely. No.
Yeah.
It was random because, I mean, we're bred to stay in Chicago, you know, for the most part. Like, you know, you're going to go to U of I or, you know, just an Illinois school, you know, Columbia, whatever.
It's funny. I went to U of I in Columbia.
Yeah, you did?
I did.
Which are amazing schools.
They're both great schools. Yeah, yeah.
And my teacher actually, in Second City, his teacher taught the high school program. There was a high school program at North Carolina School of the Arts. And he was like, I think they got a great program there. So, you know, you do all the auditions for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the places I got in. And then when I went there, I mean, by the time I was, you know, going around to colleges, I was a deadhead.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, I like the vibe here.
Oh, dude.
I really like the vibe here.
Yeah.
But I also really connected with the guy, you know, the assistant dean and my improv movement acting teacher, who were the two guys who I did the audition for. I felt like I connected the most with them in my audition process too. So it was like all those things. And I was like, I'm going to move to Chicago, New York, or LA. This is nothing like any of those places.
Yeah.
And so I'll get to experience the South, which was, yeah, a definite culture shock, especially for the first 2 years. The second 2 years, I got more used to it. And also, it's a conservatory, so you weren't really leaving the school.
Yeah,
it
yeah,
was
yeah.
all-encompassing.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, because you have a Grateful Dead shirt on, and we were talking about it beforehand.
Yeah.
And
was
that when you were, because you were.
Right, I forgot.
Yeah,
I forgot that was not recorded. That
yeah, yeah. Yeah, we didn't mention it yet. But
you
were speaking
a
little bit. Yeah, and that you, for a while, because I asked you, are you a Deadhead? And you said no. But then you said, oh, I did travel for a couple of years with them.
No, I was a Deadhead. I was a Deadhead.
Yeah, yeah.
I wouldn't say I'm a Deadhead anymore. Right. I definitely wouldn't say that. But I do love the Grateful Dead, I'm not still keeping up with the culture. And yeah, it's a lifestyle, it's a philosophy, it's a way of being. I mean,
yeah,
that is
yeah.
Unto itself. So yeah, I was more of a part of that, but I still was like, I think I always knew in the back of my mind, even when I was like, I'm a Jew.
Come on, isn't there room for Jews in the Deadhead world?
No, there's lots of Jews. No, I just was like, I'm an urban person. I'm not.
I see.
Like,
oh, I see what you mean.
I'm not a drifter. I think like and the farthest it got was like right before it was. So I went on tour with the Grateful Dead after I graduated high school, and it was right before I was going to college. And that is the part where I could have actually maybe ruined my life the most, because I literally was like, maybe I'll be a drifter like Neil Cassidy and Kerouac.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I was hanging out with some very like amazing people, but then also a lot of drug addicts.
Yes, yes.
And drifters.
Yeah.
So, you know, and they seemed free and they seemed fully like authentic to themselves. Some of them are dead. So whether they were or not, I don't know. But that like seemed very attractive as a person who was constantly measuring my own worth based on what other people thought of me. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, it felt like, oh, this could be freeing. And then I think I didn't smoke pot for like a couple days and I got a little clarity and I was like, no, I need to pursue my dream. I need to go back
to pursue
my dream.
Yeah.
And then dried out a bit.
Yeah, yeah. But you were saying too that you sold grilled cheeses and burritos and.
Oh yeah, I was all in. I had like, I didn't dread my hair because I don't agree with white people having dreadlocks.
That's a very sound stance to take.
I find it disrespectful and I find it to be cultural appropriation.
Absolutely.
I've
known people that like dreaded their hair and like, I just feel like if you have to put wood glue in your hair, your hair's not meant to do what you're trying to get it to do. Like wood glue. Nah, that's, you know, I don't think anybody in Jamaica is putting wood glue in their hair.
No. It's not like it's a whole practice that is handed down by generations.
Right.
That is a natural practice.
And it's spiritual.
It's spiritual. It's like about, it's about an actual belief in a connection with God in yourself.
Right.
And these people were just, So I hung out with like a lot of white kids who had dreads and I have really curly hair. I mean, and I used to have a full head of curly hair and it was this giant, I mean, it went from a jufro to like being a mane, and the kids were always trying to get me to dread my hair. And I never did that. I did get a hemp wrap once, but I never went dreadlocks.
Yeah.
And I remember telling them one day, this kid, he was like, why don't you dread your hair? You'll have the most beautiful dreads. You have the most beautiful dreads, man. I mean, you have the perfect hair for it. And I was like, well, man, I just, you know, I'm an actor. I might have to cut my hair one day.
Yeah.
And me telling him that, it was like I told him that I had tossed a baby out of 42nd floor story window. It was his reaction. And then he just looked at me and he just went, gonna chase those crazy bald heads out of town, which is a Bob Marley song.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a, you know, anti, I mean, white oppression. And, yeah. And I was very grateful that he sang that, because that clinched it for me. I was not so fuzzy or insecure that I couldn't see. Oh, yeah. And then that guy started doing heroin. So, you know, no shade on drug addicts. Right. It's a horrible disease. But like, right. And that's not, you know, I do believe you're born with that. But
right.
But yeah.
But yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But hey, yeah,
there, yeah, exactly. there's sort of attendant choices that might also inform the ultimate sort of falling into something that you have a predilection for.
I didn't feel very authentic when I would take a hit from the Chillum and just to fit in with the other white pseudo Rastas, praise Jah. I think I did that. Like, I was managed to do that three times, and then I was just like, "What the fuck am I doing?
I can't."
I just saw Groucho Marx's ghost sitting next to me, shaking his head, going, "You loser! You loser!"
There's also part of it that I love, that even in like drifter deadhead culture, there's peer pressure. There's still peer pressure. It's crazy. So much. You know? Yeah.
So much. It's definitely, it's not a free. I mean, I think that much like any group,
yeah,
mostly everybody's an asshole. And then you got your few special people.
Right, right.
I mean, I did like a I did Doug Benson's podcast that was, he was like, "You were a deadhead. You like follow the dead. I'm going to have an actual deadhead now." And I got an. And this deadhead had never seen the actual band. She had only seen what had existed after Garcia had died.
Wow.
And was talking to me about like the actual, like what was going on in the lot and stuff like that. I'm like, but I was there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What are you talking about? And there's a lot of that, but it was very atypical. It was very typical energy of, I mean, your average asshole.
Groups of young people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Groups of young people trying to fit in and, you know, yeah.
Herd mentality.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, no. And then it just, there was a lot more stakes. We were all really high. I mean, I was hanging out with people who sold coke to buy weed, putting themselves in very dangerous situations.
Sure. I did not. Sure.
There were deadhead gangs. There were like kids who were like, and this happened, I think this started to gestate more like as the, on the fish lot too, but there were like former friends of mine who like went down this dark path of being in like gangs on the dead lot. It was very, very strange. Very strange.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
It's a whole, there's a lot of pockets of different types of people, you know, in that whole world there. That's actually, it's pretty fascinating.
I bet. But,
and also very disturbing.
Yeah.
In not just the, you know, wavy gravy, lazy daisy way. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I can imagine. I can imagine. That's, yeah. They were talking on Howard Stern a little while ago about how there are nitrous gangs. Like selling tanks, you know, and at dead shows and fish shows, people selling balloons of nitrous outside in the parking lot. And there are violent gangs that control that market. And it's just, I don't know why it's sort of stunning that like, an illegal drug that can be quite lucrative and that has a marketplace and a very healthy market, you know, like people, a customer base that's very robust. Like, of course, it's going to get violent. It's going to get weird. It's going to get ugly.
It never went to violence, but I definitely, like, friends of mine, and I might have even had a piece of it. I don't totally remember, to be honest. I was never part of any of the wheeling and dealing of the nitrous tanks. I think maybe like a couple times people were like, "Hey, you want in on this? And, you know, give us $100 and you'll get a cut." And I was like, okay. And then I'd be like, ooh, that felt bad. but yeah, there'd be like nitrous parties in these tanks. I mean, they are, if they are in a house or on the lot, they are stolen. I mean, they are stolen from a truck. And so there's definite criminal activity going on.
Sure, sure.
And it's dark. It's very dark. I mean, it is like, you know, it's people basically like huffing down big balloons to pass out. And that is, I mean, there's a lot of darkness there.
Yeah.
And it was, in a lot of ways, a very dark period for me.
Yeah.
Really dark period for me. Yeah.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
You get out of college. You get out of college. I mean, you know, and I mean, and good for you to like understand too that like, no, this is fun. But I, you know, I have, you know, dreams to remember, to quote another, you know, another reggae lyric. You know, and after you're out of school, do you have connections to go to New York, or and is New York just there because it's there, you know, because it's the closest one?
I think that was it was just expected from the school. I think it was expected, like you go to New York and then you start, you live there, you do regional theater. And if you're lucky, then you do off Broadway. Then eventually you find yourself on Broadway and then you'll eventually find yourself doing film.
Mm.
And, I think like TV was not as respected by the, you know, student body, by the faculty. I'm sure it is now, though. I mean, it was a different era of TV.
It ought to be. It's totally
different. Yeah, I mean, it's become, you know, with HBO, you know, with things like The Sopranos and Larry Sanders and Sex and the City, it became cinematic, you know. It just got higher value. But there was lots of great TV before that. I don't mean to disparage incredible art that was going on television before
But I think what's amazing now and this sort of TV renaissance thing is that there's things on like the lower tier of streamers that are fucking fantastic that nobody even knows about. You know, like just like there's just such a high quality of work, whereas when there'd be, you know, you could sort of count on the sort of off-brand television stuff when you and I were younger would probably be shitty. You know what I mean? Like, it's probably great. Like that new thing that you hear about that's on, I don't, you know, Peacock or, you know, Tubi or whatever.
Exactly.
It's like, oh, that's like fucking awesome. Yeah. Epics, all these, you know, ones. And you know, I mean, there's so many things that I hear about. I have to like Google where is it, you know, like to find where it is. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you got like things like Top Boy and Southside and Enlightened and Getting On and Better Things, you know, I feel like Better, you know, Pamela doesn't get enough credit for just how brilliant that show is.
That show is fantastic. You know? I got to get her on here. She's somebody that I think about and I'm like, hey, she needs to come on here, and then I forget about it. So,
oh yeah, you guys would be. Right, I mean, I've only met her once, but oh, that'd be amazing to listen to a conversation between you two. Yeah, and so I wound up in New York, and you do this thing where you do like two scenes that are like 5 minutes, and some people who were more musical theater inclined did like a song and a scene. So I played the James Coco role from Last of the Red Hot Lovers by Neil Simon, which is a 50-year-old character. And I played Roy Cohn's doctor from Angels in America, who is also a 50-year-old character. And I was just like, hey, should I play like younger people since this is for agents and casting directors? And I think at even that time, I thought like I knew they didn't necessarily have the most creative mindset when it came to signing new clients, you know? And they're like, no, great acting is great acting. And they were wrong. I was right.
Yes,
and nobody signed me. And
it's
then
an
John
incredibly
Daly.
Uncreative part of the business. Casting is incredibly uncreative.
Yeah. I mean, there's those great casting directors who are artists.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's, I mean, I guess like, again, the majority of any field in anything aren't great at what they do, you know?
Chosen
people. Yeah.
And there's a lot of it that's filling slots. Like we need a villain. Okay, how about I got a drawer full of villains, you know? We need bumbling idiots. I got a drawer full of bumbling idiots. And if you score well as a bumbling idiot, you know, like you mentioned Cabin Boy. After I did Cabin Boy, I had been doing all kinds of auditions for all kinds of different parts, and I was very happy with that. And after Cabin Boy, it was just idiots. It was just like just stupid. That's all I would get for, you know, a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, everybody wants me to be a piece of shit nowadays. And it's like, I mean, if it's an interesting piece of shit, I'll do it. But
yeah. Yeah.
I mean, an interesting character is an interesting character, but yeah, no. So I didn't get signed. I had one meeting with one person that was an advice meeting. And she was like, "You're a character actor, kid. You'll work when you're 50. It's like, thanks.
but until then, you're on your own.
But John Daly, you know, yes, John Daly, right?
I do. Very funny comedian and actor. Yeah.
Old friend of mine.
Saxophone player.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And and I've known him for almost 30 years. And
yeah.
He went to North Carolina for 2 years and then left. And, he went right to New York, and then we kept in touch, obviously. And then he was like, "You got to check out this place. I'm working with this group called the Upright Citizens Brigade." And then by the time I had moved to New York, UCB had just moved into the first place on 22nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, "But I'm going to be on Broadway. I'm going to be doing, you know, Shakespeare, Simon Pinter, and Chekhov. Like, I'm not going to do this improv and sketch thing that we messed around with in college and that I did in high school. I'm beyond that now." And agent said, "No, you're not." And then I went there, and I remember going to my first ASCAT and being like, "Holy shit, this is art happening here. This is incredibly innovative stuff." You know,
yeah.
I believe you were in the, first ASCAT I saw, and I was like, "Oh my God, there's Andy Richter." I was like, I think Conan did the first monologue.
He could have,
the first ASCAT that I saw.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then you had like, you had the four of them. You had Tina before Weekend Update. You had Rachel before being on the show.
Tina
you had
Fey, McKay, Rachel Dratch. Yeah. Adam
Rachel
McKay.
Dratch.
Yeah.
You had Adam before, you know, while he was head writer of SNL, you know, you had John Glazer doing the funniest things that I had ever seen. You all were doing the funniest things that I'd ever seen on stage. And I was like, "Oh, this is not fucking around at all. And this is something that I'm incredibly intimidated by too, that I don't know how to do, even though I've done improv for a while. I don't know how to do it like this." And then I started taking classes, and I rose up I got on stage real quick because, I mean, I was one of the only people who knew how to be on the stage at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, a lot of people that were like, "Wow, you're fucking weird. You make me laugh when I'm high. Get on stage. You're in a Herald team, baby."
Yeah. Yeah.
So I was a little more than that.
Yeah. The one that I always noticed was, "Oh, you keep acting when you're not talking." Like there seemed to be so many people that would just, when they were talking, they'd act, and then they'd just stand there to wait to talk and act again, you know, but there was no, there was like no occupying the space within the thing, except when they were speaking.
Then it was like a type of, it was like living art. It was like, that person is unlike any human being that I've ever seen before. And that that was really cool to see truly strange people doing that,
who
weren't necessarily performers, but who were genuinely odd.
Yes.
And so I was also genuinely odd, but also had all of this training. And so, yeah, I got on a Herald team really fast. And then even before that was doing a sketch show there. And so, yeah. And then
with John?
Yeah.
Yeah.
John was in my first sketch group. Yeah. My first two sketch groups The first sketch show I ever did at UCB was called The Grizz.
Uh-huh.
And John Ross Bowie directed us, and it was me and John and this guy and a friend named Vadim Newquist,
mm-hmm.
Who's, you know, not doing a comedy, I don't think. I mean, I haven't talked to him in quite a while.
Yeah, yeah.
But, yeah, so that was the first show. And then, you know, you get that, like, nod from Matt Besser. John wrote, well, John was already on a Herald team by the time I started doing UCB. So yeah, I rose up the ranks like pretty fast. And then you got into the pool of familial, dysfunctional competition.
Yeah.
Just like every comedian does, whether you're an improv and sketch comedian or you're a stand-up.
Yeah.
It's like, every comedian then becomes family. There is nobody who you love or hate anymore than all of your friends in comedy.
Yes, all those people that mean the most to you. Yeah.
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 Just like, oh, wow, you're so awful. But you let me be awful, too. So I love you.
Yes. Yeah. And also, too, when you're young, I always found, too, when you're young, like I could take, like I enjoyed watching dysfunction bounce up against dysfunction and sparks fly. And then,
You know,
and I mean, when I was young, that was, oh, wow, look at this crazy people being crazy at each other. And then time goes on, you're like, oh, this is too, it's just tiring. It's just, I just want to take a nap now because, you know,
it's not fun
anymore.
It was exhilarating to watch people to be like, wow, they might be institutionalized tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes I was one of those people. truly irresponsible, incredibly irresponsible behavior.
Yeah.
And now I like seeing that mimicked. I love seeing that mimicked, but not actually lived out. I like people using that from their past, and I like to use that, but without it having real life repercussions.
Yeah. What was it hard? Did you give up kind of on your Broadway-ish kind of dreams? You know, I mean, how soon? Because Eagle Heart was like the first steady acting thing you had.
Yeah, that was my first like real job. And
I mean,
that I was proud of. Yeah.
Oh, because it's, well, that show is crazy. I love showing that show to people that don't know about that show because it's mind blower.
I think Chris is one of the most genius comedy performers of all time. I think Chris is like, you top five most underappreciated comedians of all time, like just on the level of genius of the man. And like, if you've only seen him, Eagle Heart was great. It was exciting for me because I had already idolized Chris so much, and to see Jason and, you know, Jason Wallner and Michael Coman and Andrew Weinberg, who created the show and wrote all the scripts, create something for him that I thought supported that genius again, you know, since what he was doing in Cabin Boy and Get a Life and all of his work on Letterman and his Cinemax specials that, like, you know, not enough people have seen that are some of the most, like, brilliant, you know, FDR, A One-Man Show, and Action Family are two of the most genius pieces of comedy ever made.
Yeah.
And so I got that gig. It was a while, though. I mean, I had moved to Los Angeles by the time I got Eagle Heart.
So
I hadn't give up on my Broadway dreams. I think I was too insecure at the time to tackle another scene. And I remember I went to one, there was this group called Naked Angels, which was,
you don't mean like a scene in a play. You mean like a happening,
the community, an environment.
Okay.
Yeah. And I went to one Naked Angels, meeting, and I was just like, I was very inspired by it. And then I was scared, you know, I'm ashamed to say that it is a regret that I have that I was not also simultaneously, pursuing the off Broadway and Broadway while I was pursuing comedy as well. I've been trying to get back there. I'd love to start doing plays again too. And but it just seemed like the comedy scene was such a huge mountain to keep climbing anyway, especially before I was working.
Right.
That I just was like, let's just stick to this.
Yeah.
You know, I can't like crack a whole community and be like, hi, how you doing? I'm the new guy again.
Right.
It took so long to not be the new guy at UCB and not be the new guy in like the alt stand up scene too.
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah. I don't blame you. That's like pretty sound reasoning, if you ask me. Yeah, it's like and especially you're already halfway there. Like, why go start again?
Exactly. You know? And I had pride in like I thought I saw what we were doing, or you know what me and a lot of my peers was doing is theater. It just wasn't in the same form, but it was acting. It was theater,
and it was also in many ways. Inventing itself as it went along, whereas theater can tend to be sort of, I think it's a lot harder to do that in legit theater because legit theater has had such a head start to explore all different kind of avenues that it's like, it's hard to do something new in legit theater. Whereas when you're doing, you know, improv, that kind of improv sketch, there's Second City there's the Groundlings, but it was always evolving into more stuff that was more just interesting and different.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, there's of course so much like non-commercial theater that was also doing that. But in terms of off-Broadway and Broadway, it's a fight, you know, in the same way that it is in film and television for, you know, artists to really realize their vision. It's a real fight to do that. And in improv and sketch, it's like, you ain't got no, you know, once the lights go on, it's like, there's no more leash.
Yeah.
I can do, I mean, with certain like Second City and Groundling reviews, but, you know, to the side, like, you know, a lot of work at Second City and the Groundlings. And then of course at UCB and then IO was just like, you have no leash on me at all. I can do whatever I want here. I can be terrible and not lose my job.
Yeah. Job and, you know, sort of job with air quotes around it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not getting paid.
Yeah. Right. So fire like, me. Go ahead.
No, but there was real innovative. It made me, there's no doubt. I don't think that like, I mean, doing UCB made me a better actor. There's doubt in my mind. It made me a much better actor. It like, you learn so much technique at a conservatory. And then, like, being really terrible for a few years.
Really?
At something, you know, a lot of times, you know, bombing is is amazing training. And also the innovation of what we were learning and what we were inventing as we went along. And linking up with people who were like-minded and all that. So,
Yeah.
And then theater opened in L.A., I'd sort of like hit the glass ceiling of what I thought I was going to accomplish in New York. And I was like, well, now I have no excuse. And I had taken trips out to LA and been performing at the theater and Death Ray and stuff, Comedy Death Ray, which became Comedy Bang Bang.
Right.
Now I felt that people were more into my stuff too. And so then I came to LA and then that sort of just coincided with Jason Wallner coming to Los Angeles too. And then Jason's the reason I got Eagle Heart. So, and then
rest Jason. Is history.
And then fame, light, action, sex.
I slid right into a big champagne glass.
Yes, every day is sunshine and glory over here. Oh, oh, never, never a tear, never a frown. Jesus.
Well, you know, but I mean, well, you've gotten to do so much, you know, a lot of really fun, crazy stuff. And it's, you know.
No, I'm so grateful. No, I am grateful. I don't think I live a life of struggle.
No, well, I mean, you know, everybody's, you know, that's the thing. Every, you know, you can't be a Pollyanna either. It's like, you know, life is life and you have all these good things happen, but there's still 60 seconds in every minute and 60
minutes in every hour, and you got to fill them up with with the personality that has been poured into you. And, you know, and so it's like, yeah, you can't always be like, it would be counterproductive
No, I mean, you have to recognize that. I mean, yeah, I just, that's the internal struggle that I'm talking about. Yeah, my brain, not my life. My life is a charmed, you know, beautiful life. I have a better, you know, we have a better life than most, you know, than the majority, the vast majority of the earth. And, but yeah, we still have, I mean, that's sort of like what Lenin was talking about in his goal. I don't remember. And I mean, Vladimir, not John, but that was his whole original ideal with what the revolution would do. Right. I'm not a socialist or communist, but I'm relating it to, I heard this quote by him where it had something to do with, I want to end the external struggles so human beings only have to deal with the internal struggle with the privilege of that. And so I think, that's where I've always been at. I didn't grow up poor, you know, I've never like truly worried about money. It's not like my parents were buying me an apartment in Union Square when I was in New York, but like I knew that if I ran out of money, I wouldn't be on the street, you know? Yeah. And so that's a really lucky place to be.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Well, what's your dream coming true? Like what coming going forward? What do you, where would you, are there like certain things you would like things that have remained unanswered, you know, like urges?
Dreams. I want to work with more great people and work and play more great roles. I want to direct and, you know, be more of like an auteur, I guess. Mm-hmm. I want to achieve that. I want to be the lead in things as long as those roles are really, you know, interesting. I want to, you know, I'm ready for the show to be mine, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And not that I see everything as an ensemble piece regardless, but you know, where I'm taking up the, you know, carrying the thing acting wise on my shoulders a lot. I really want to step, I'm ready to really step into that. And whether that is a film or a television show.
Yeah.
And then also I'd love to, and start getting on stage more. Those are really like the things. And then I think I want to make like a comedy special. I haven't done that since Jason Wallner and I did our trilogy that we did for Adult Swim, which were basically like one act plays. Mm-hmm. I haven't done it since then and nobody watched. I mean, it's strange.
I saw one of them. I remember seeing one of them, but I haven't seen all three. So yeah.
Yeah. The fact that those were on television were really, I mean, that's insane. But I'd like to bring my own, I feel like, you know, just how you do, I'm sure like nobody does, every comedian, nobody does what they do exactly. And so I'd like to put that out there again too. So those are really the big goals. And then life wise, I want to have kids and get in the best shape of my life. Yeah.
Are you serious about that? I mean, is that like a,
yeah.
That's good.
I want to get, you know, more fit not that I feel like I look bad. It's not really for looks as much as it is for versatility of the roles I play and health.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have such a fucking hard time. I have all the desire like, man, I'd really like to, but it's not even so much eating. It's the cardio. It's doing exercise. I don't like it. You know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I've done it, you know, when I started making enough money that I could join a gym and work out with somebody. I've been doing it like since I was, you know, early 30s. And I have always been waiting for that thing of like just the people that are like, oh man, while I'm on vacation, I hope they have a gym there. And I'm always like, what the fuck is wrong with you? You know, like, what?
Oh, yeah.
You know, I just have never gotten to that, man, I need to work out because I feel so good. I still, after however many years, 20 some years of working out, my body is constantly, well, not constantly, but at least for the first 10 minutes. Hey, stop. Cut it out. I don't like this. hey,
yeah.
Stop it. You know?
Yeah. The before and the beginning of the workout.
Yeah.
Hate.
Yeah. Yeah.
The later, during, and after love.
Yeah.
And then the before and during, I hate eating healthy. I hate it.
Yeah.
But I'm doing like a cleanse now and going to go on like a diet because the next thing I'm doing, I want to lose some weight for. But I also like, I think being big too is sexy too. You know, mm-hmm. I think it's all about attitude, you know,
yeah.
like feeling good about yourself. And so really it's just about me wanting to like continue to shift how people see me as an actor of like what the roles are that I can play and then challenge myself to transform into the character that I'm going to play. And then health-wise, you know, I got bad mm-hmm. genes. I got
oh,
bad
yeah,
genes.
Yeah. 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 That's important to head that off at the pass as much as you can.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to get heart disease or diabetes yeah. if I can help it. But you know, there's a way to turn that around too. So it's not like, so yeah. So that's really the thing. And I do dig it. I mean, I started training in karate for Stranger Things and I really do enjoy that.
Oh,
and
cool.
That's fun because I mean, it's sort of like being a kid in a way.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's
and you're
really
exercising,
hard.
But you're still, yeah, but you're still, you're kind of dancing and fighting all at once. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, wow, I just learned how to do a back kick.
Yeah.
And I'm sweating. I'm like sweating profusely and out of breath.
Yeah. Yeah.
And my trainer is like this master who is very serious about it, but also nice, but also very kind.
Do you have to call him sensei?
I have to call him master.
Really?
Do. He asked me to, and the reason, not like when we're talking in life, but when we're training, he's like, because what I'm teaching you is so aggressive. He's teaching me to be able to kill someone with my
body. Right.
I mean, this guy, he's like, I don't even know how old he is. Like, I know he is probably in his 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
But I don't know because he looks very young.
Yeah.
And because he's, you know, been in amazing shape his whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm like, oh, and this guy is the kindest, most, he's a gentle soul, but I also know he could kill me in like 3 seconds.
Yeah.
And so he's like, I'm teaching you this aggressive thing. And so you calling me master humbles you to balance that out.
Oh.
And so I was like, oh, that's a very practical thing. You know, that's very, and that's the cool thing about it too. There's a philosophy with it too,
mm-hmm.
of passivity as your end knowledge and knowing oneself as you learn to kill people with your hands and
right.
feet.
But only in a reactive way, not in an aggressive way.
Only in a reactive
way. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Never use might for right.
Right.
Never use violence for selfish means, but only to develop might for right is part of the student credo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's cool, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what do you
never thought you'd hear those words coming out of my mouth?
I'm writing it down right now.
I just lost at least 10 fans saying that. But I might have gained 5. So that's
right.
Cool.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Soon you will be called master. Well, thank you so much for spending this time. You know, the final question is the what you've learned part of like, what do you think? Like, can you boil Brett Gelman down into a punchy little, you know, something to button a podcast with?
Yeah. I mean, what I've learned is, I mean, it goes off of what we've been talking about before is, I mean, really, think before I react.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a thing that I try to learn every day and that I'm still learning, and to get out of my own way of my own happiness. I am the one who is blocking my happiness more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
So, to work on that.
Are you getting better at that?
I think so. You know, it's still a struggle, Because, yeah, I don't know. My mind's the, my brain's the way. It's been a long way living this way. But, yeah, I think I am definitely getting better at that. I think I am. Yeah.
Does, what aspect of the change in your life as you've gotten older has assisted you in making that change the most?
I think allowing more and more love in my life. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, you know, treating myself, making choices, I think, taking actions that are supportive, productive, kind actions towards myself. I can't think myself into any state of being really, but mm-hmm. I can make choices and take actions that will then instinctually reconfigure my synapses and my brain in order to, and reconfigure my self-esteem to make myself feel better about myself. So like, I mean, it's cheesy, but like to really take actions that are more of a movement towards, I think we're like, you know, this is obvious, but we're always moving. We're organisms. So we're either moving forward or we're moving backwards. We're either taking steps towards health or we're taking steps towards lack of health. We're taking mm-hmm. steps towards love or we're taking steps towards insecurity and fear and all of that. And, but also I think part of that self-love is like learning that those steps back are also learning opportunities to take mm-hmm. more steps forward, and that that's not ugly. That's human.
Yeah.
And so I think like trying to love the mess that I am while at the same time making choices that are not so messy.
Yeah. Yeah. A huge thing that a crossroads that I came to in my life was just the basic logic of when people talk shitty to me, I'm not inspired to help them or do what they want. And why don't I recognize that in myself? Like when I talk shitty to myself, like why would I honor that guy? That guy's an asshole. He just told me all kinds of awful stuff about me, but it's me that's doing it. So it's like, if I tell myself nice things, I'm much more likely to pursue the stuff that I know I should be doing or that I want to do or make the improvements and the changes that I want to make. And it took a long, long time because I think, I don't know what it is exactly, but there's something in us that thinks like if we're really mean to ourselves and really hard on ourselves, I don't know if it's like the stern daddy kind of thing. Like we think that that's good and that's manly and that we're like, we're, you know, before anyone else can punish us for our bad choices, we're going to punish ourselves really, really hard. And that it's self-aggrandizing. And it acts like you're acting like you're making progress or like you're being a hard ass and really, you know, taking a firm line with yourself. But all you're doing is just wallowing in the same old shit. You're just in a little cycle that makes you feel good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. In addition to that, I mean, that's me to a T. And in addition to that, I think like me creating problems in my life or being unkind to myself, I think is maybe a defense mechanism at times out of fear to like avoid life doing bad things to me.
Mm. Yeah.
Like, well, if I create the negativity, then life won't do that.
Right.
And that's me saying to myself, well, I don't deserve to be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to beat life to the punch. Life won't make me miserable. I'll make me miserable. Fuck you, life. Yeah,
exactly. To keep life from killing me, I'll just ruin all of my relationships.
Good job. You showed life.
Woo.
Woo-wee.
Life's got a big thumbs up. Yeah, no, totally. So, I mean, I think that's, but I also have learned if you're worth a damn, you struggle with that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not interested in any saintly type.
No.
You know, putting out this perfect adjusted thing, you know, it's cliche, but they wind up being the most screwed up people a lot of the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Or sometimes not. Sometimes they're amazing.
Yeah. But yeah, but no, most of the time, especially out here, like usually the person that's crowing the most about how well put together they are is like, that's the lady protesting too much, which I think is another reggae lyric.
That's the great thing about our community too, and like coming up in our community, and then who it led me to have taste for, of having friend relationships with. Very few people that we know on a day-to-day basis have any tolerance towards that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whatsoever. So that's great.
Yeah, it's, yeah, it is. It's good. It's humbling, but it's also, I think it's like, it's striving for authenticity, at least in our own little group, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, Brett, thank you so much for taking the time.
Andy.
And good luck, you know, with everything.
Thank you, man.
And
you too.
And I hope to see you around soon, you know, if I ever leave the house.
I hope so too. Yeah. No, let's hang.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I would love that. Yeah.
Okay.
No, it really means a lot, you having me on, really.
I'm happy to do it. It was a great conversation.
Thank you, man. Yeah.
And thank all of you out there for listening to this episode of the Three Questions. I will be back next week. I mean, maybe Brett will come along next week too, but probably not. You probably got stuff to do, but.
I mean, it depends what time and where. I'll be back. I'll be back as soon as you want me.
All right. Three more questions.
Yeah,
all right.
Exactly.
I'll be back next week. Thanks a lot. Got a big, big love
for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts. Can't you tell my love's a-growing?